Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Samuel Totten. As many of the regular listeners to the show already know, Sam is one of the giants in the field of genocide studies. His publications are too numerous to mention here, but any list would have to start with one of the standard textbooks in the field, called Centuries of Genocide. In addition to being a scholar, Sam is active in human rights work as well. The book we're going to use here as a starting point comes at the intersection of both of these interests. Genocide by Attrition, The Nuba Mountains of Sudan, published by Transaction Publishers, is a concise, powerful work that examines the government of Sudan's offensives against the Nuba people in the last decades of the 20th century and the first years of the 21st. It combines historical analysis with moving interviews and a discussion of contemporary affairs in the Sudan. This book, unlike many we've discussed on the show, differs because the violence it discusses is still ongoing. Because of that, we're also going to discuss recent events in the Sudan and the response of both genocide scholars and the American government to that violence. For those listeners interested in pursuing this topic, I'd recommend looking at the most recent issue of Genocide Studies International. This issue includes several articles addressing the Nuba and recent events in the Sudan, and it also lays out a fiery critique of genocide studies as being too academic, one that I found quite thought-provoking. That's a busy agenda, so perhaps we should get to it. So with that, Sam, welcome, and thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to speaking with you today.
So as I was doing the research to suggest this interview to you, I Googled you, as most people do now, to find your email address. And I have to confess, I was somewhat shocked to find out that you were housed at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, in the Education Department. Maybe we can start by asking you to say something about how you got there.
That's a question that I often get. It ended up being a very strange place for me to be. There's no doubt about that, especially as I became more immersed in the field of genocide studies. But I went to graduate school at Columbia University and got a doctorate in curriculum theory, and ultimately got a job at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville in the College of Education, teaching courses and doing research on curriculum theory. But throughout for years and years, going back to the late 1970s, I'd been involved in human rights work. In fact, I worked for Amnesty International in Australia between 1976 and 78, and continued my work over the years in human rights. So when I got to the University of Arkansas, I also continued writing about human rights issues. And the change over to a focus almost exclusively on genocide took place probably about 7 years after I first accepted the job in 1988 at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And that was a result of just becoming more immersed in conducting research and working with others on chapters and books, or working with them on different projects related to genocide. And it became very uncomfortable being in the Department of Curriculum Instruction in the College of Education, because a lot of people did see it as, and they told me this up front, they saw it as really not having anything to do with education, which I disputed. But for a good number of years, there was a real battle between myself and the dean and the department chair, because I was doing so much publishing in the field of genocide studies. I guess the only saving grace as far as the department was concerned is I was also doing research on in the field of education at the same time.
What made you originally interested in human rights?
Well, it goes back to, actually, I had graduated in 1972 as an English major, And I decided to move to San Francisco and with the hope of writing and publishing a novel. And so I ended up living actually in a in just on the periphery of Chinatown in this old hotel. It was only $15 a week, if you can believe that. And I would write during the day. I knew nobody in San Francisco. I really didn't become friends with anybody in San Francisco, so I would write all day. But then in the evening, I would go to what is now a famous bookstore, City Lights Bookstore, owned by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the beat poets. And every evening, I would go downstairs to this table and sit down, and I would bring a number of books there that I'd been reading, and I would continue reading. Well, one evening I came across, there was a journal on top of this table, and splayed across the front of the cover was something to the extent of, I think it said, torture in Chile. And it was an article by Rose Styron, a very well-known human rights activist. Her husband was the famous novelist, William Styron. And I read that, and I was flabbergasted. Flabbergasted for a couple of different reasons. One, probably from sixth grade forward, I always read the newspaper, and I thought I had read it pretty thoroughly, and at that time it was the Los Angeles Times, but I'd never heard how pervasive torture was across the globe. And so I was absolutely astonished that when she talked about how ubiquitous it was, that I was ignorant of this fact. And it also disturbed me because I had started out as a history major but changed over to English, but I'd never heard of about contemporary torture either in any of these courses. And so it really not only intrigued me, but it was rather devastating reading about these acts of torture against these dissidents. And that really was the impetus of all of my work in the field of human rights and ultimately genocide studies.
I want to get to the book in just a second here, but one last kind of introductory question, and that is to say, when you started writing in the field of genocide studies, the field was really just emerging. And I'm wondering if you could, when you started writing, did you have a sense that this even was a field and where that field should go, or did this kind of emerge organically as you tackled individual projects?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, at the time, it certainly was not a field. I think there were individuals within this discipline, if you want to call it a discipline even, who were hoping that it would become a field of studies. But it was a very, very small group of individuals. In fact, it was quite interesting because if you were in this field and publishing on a regular basis, you slowly but surely became not only conversant with most of the people in the field, if not all of them, but you know, on a first name basis, you got to know them fairly well. And the way that I ultimately began writing was I had met a fellow named Israel Sharney, who was one of the early pioneers in the field. And at that time, when I met him, I was an English teacher at the Walworth Barber American International School in Israel, and I just happened to have his student, his son, in class. And we became fast friends. That is Israel Sharney, the father of my students. And we started attending Amnesty International meetings together and talking about genocide. He was at that time working on his first book on genocide. And so I ended up writing three chapters for another one of his books. And that was really the beginning of my scholarly efforts in the field. But yeah, at that time, it was just individuals, really, who were interested in the area of genocide and really just contacted one another. I mean, at the time we didn't have internet, so we were writing letters back and forth, and that's the way we communicated and got to know one another. But slowly but surely, in the early 90s, an organization, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, was started, and that was really the impetus for beginning, I think, a field of studies, and it really exploded in the late 1990s. But up until that time, no, we were just working away and hoping to draw attention to the issue.
So how did the Sudan start to figure in your research?
Yes, well, it was the summer of 2004. I was asked to join a project called the Atrocities Documentation Project. It was a project that was sponsored by USAID and the U.S. State Department, and it was a team of what they called investigators that was sent to the eastern Chad in the refugee camps along the Chad-Darfur border. And these so-called investigators interviewed refugees from Darfur who had been expelled from their villages and homes as a result of the attacks by the government of Sudan and the Janjaweed. And so at that time, 2004, I was in a place called Gozbeda, and we interviewed approximately, I had a team member, we all had team members, and we interviewed approximately, I think it was 56 individuals. In total, the entire team interviewed, I believe it was 1,137 individuals, and all of that data went back to the State Department. Ultimately, Colin Powell used that data to come to the decision that Sudan had perpetrated genocide against the people of Darfur and probably was still doing so. That then was the impetus for me to go back on my own to the refugee camps to continue conducting research into what was happening in Darfur, interviewing individuals in different refugee camps. And and throughout that time, I was trying to get into Darfur in Sudan. Mm-hmm. But I could not get a visa from the government of Sudan. They simply refused to give me one. And my sense was it was because I had been part of this Atrocities Documentation Project, and I had published about the results of this project. Ultimately, several years later, I was on a Fulbright in Rwanda, and I was coming back to the United States to give a talk at the University of Chicago. And I just inadvertently bumped into this fellow in Nairobi who was getting on the plane who had been working in Sudan. We started talking. Long story short, he told me how I could get into Sudan without a visa. And from there, I began going into the Nuba Mountains. And I would go in on a NGO plane, non-governmental organization plane, and we would land on a field. It wasn't an airport. There was no air controllers or anything like that. We would simply get off this plane and walk away and walk into the village. So nobody in Sudan, the Sudanese government, knew that I was there, so it was not a problem. More recently, and we can talk about this, those flights are no longer flying into Sudan because there's a no-fly zone. So now I have to cross the border illegally from South Sudan into Sudan and then head up into the Nuba Mountains.
You seem to have a habit, actually, of bumping into people on planes. That's how you met your interpreter, right?
Yeah, that's an incredible story. Indeed. I was this first time that I was heading to the Nuba Mountains, I went to Wilson Field in Nairobi early in the morning and got there to hop on this NGO flight. And I'd say there are probably on this flight, there may be 8 or 9 people. And we were standing around after we had loaded this plane. The plane was basically a cargo plane that had seats in it. So we all pitched in, loaded the plane. And so I was standing there by myself, and this fellow, at the time, he's changed his name since. His name was Ramadan. He now refers to himself as Alexander. But Ramadan was standing there, and we started talking, and he was a very nice fellow, and we ended up sitting on the plane together. Long story short, he had not been home to see his parents in 10 years because he left when he was 11 years old because he wanted to study. He wanted to earn his high school diploma, and most of the schools had been shut down in the Nuba Mountains because of the crisis back in the 1990s. So he hadn't seen his family for 10 years. He was going back for the first time. And basically I said, I told him what I was doing. And I said, you know, your English is really impressive. And would you be interested in serving as an interpreter? And went from there.
Well, some of our listeners will know the Sudan well, but many will not. So can we start briefly by having you describe where the Sudan is, who the Nuba people are, and their situation within the Sudan, say, before this conflict started?
Sure, yeah. Well, Sudan happens to be the largest country in Africa. It's huge. And it's there. It borders a number of different countries. It's south of Egypt. And the rest of the countries that it borders are, for example, Chad, the Central African Republic, the DRC, that is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Uganda, small piece of Kenya, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. So as one can imagine, I mean, it really takes up a huge piece of property. And just mentioning those different areas, Chad, Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, if people have a sense of what's happening there, Ethiopia and Eritrea, I mean, this is an area that is rife with conflict. And so there's a lot of conflict along the borders, but within Sudan, there's been great conflict as well, and not just recently, but pretty much since its birth as a nation in 1956. As far as the Nuba Mountains, it is located in a state called South Kordofan. And South Kordofan today borders the new nation of the Republic of South Sudan. So it's in the south of Sudan, that is the state of South Kordofan, and the Nuba Mountains are pretty much in the heart or the middle of South Kordofan. And it's a relatively small area, but a fascinating area. I mean, there are about 52 tribal groups in the area, and it's comprised of very, very small villages. Basically, it's a dusty area, though it dusty area which receives a lot of rain during the rainy season, incredible amounts of rain. In fact, the rainy season is from roughly April to November, and it rains so much that you really cannot get around very well, if at all, at least in vehicles at that time, because everything becomes very swampy. But the Nuba Mountains, part of it, is also considered breadbasket of Sudan. So they do grow they grow a lot of produce, and that was another part of the problem back in the 90s, is that the government of Sudan wanted to go in and take over a lot of the land, basically to establish what they referred to as mechanized farms, gigantic farms, which ended up taking away land from the local farmers. So it's very, very hilly, and then the mountains are very steep, and within the mountains there are a lot of caves. Nobody lives in the mountains except for when they flee up there during these attacks that we'll be talking about.
How then, so the Sudan emerges out of the colonial period. How does the conflict in the Sudan begin, and how did the people in the Nuba fit into the broader constellation of forces there?
Yeah, well, there were two what they refer to as civil wars, and the Nuba Mountains factored into the Second Civil War, which was fought between roughly 1983 and 2005. The South, and when I talk about the South, I'm talking about states basically around South Kordofan. There were at the time Northern Kordofan, and in areas not Darfur at this time, but all the way down to where the current state of the Republic of South Sudan is, basically had asked for, insisted on, demanded they demanded what they considered were their basic human rights. They also complained about the fact that they felt disenfranchised. Disenfranchised politically because they felt that they did not have adequate representation in the parliament. Disenfranchised economically because there really was nothing put into the South in regard to an infrastructure that would help the people with their livelihoods. Disenfranchised in various ways vis-a-vis their infrastructure, meaning in this area, just as in Darfur, for that matter, I mean, there are no roads to speak of. I mean, every road that I travel on when I'm in the Nuba Mountains is dirt. It's rutted. It's bumpy, dusty. No bridges, and there are a lot of rivers that you have to cross. They're called wadis there, and when they're filled with water, it's almost impossible to get across at times because the rain is so torrential. Very few hospitals and very few schools, and so basically they were demanding these basic rights, and the government of Sudan pretty much ignored them. And there was a revolt called the Boer Revolt early on, led by a fellow named John Garang, who ultimately became the leader of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement Army, which is generally referred to as the SPLM/A. And that Boer Revolt ignited the Second Civil War. And this war, this Second Civil War, went on for 20 years, and astoundingly, 2 million people were killed during the course of this war. And slowly but surely, the people in the Nuba Mountains started to be drawn in to this war. Initially, they were not a part of it, but what generally happened is that, first of all, there were nomadic groups that were close to the government of Sudan who entered the Nuba Mountains and started trying to use the land of the sedentary people, which is very similar to what happened in Darfur, and that caused a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the SPLM started recruiting the people in the Nuba Mountains, and the fighting went north. Well, it went north for the people in the South, and obviously the North came down into the Nuba Mountains as well. And that was in the late 1980s. So it was a good while after the war started that the Nuba really started to become part and parcel of this Second Civil War. And they were drawn into this, and the more they were drawn into it, the greater focus there was by the government of Sudan on the Nuba Mountains. And a lot of men were leaving their families, and what they did is they ended up going south because they would be trained by the SPLM, and then they would come back up to the Nuba Mountains and fight from the Nuba Mountains area. Because of that, the government of Sudan would come in and not only go after the rebels, and again, this is a parallel with Darfur, would not only go after the rebels, but basically what they did was they would carry out a scorched earth policy in which they went after virtually everybody and anybody in the Nuba Mountains, meaning that they would go in and bomb villages. They ground troops would go in and attack villages, killing people, chasing people away. People went up into the mountains seeking sanctuary. At one and the same time, this is the one thing that's radically different from what's happening today is that the government of Sudan at that time, and I'm talking now the early 1990s, established what they referred to as peace camps, which was a euphemism basically for concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And they would pull the people, capture families, villages, and force them into these camps. And since, you know, most of the men were away fighting, these camps were heavily populated by women and the elderly. Oftentimes the children were taken away from their families and placed in fundamentalist Islamic schools, and basically, at least this is the way the Nuba Mountains people would perceive it, or did perceive it, brainwashed into, you know, a new way of thinking. Because I should note that in the Nuba Mountains, there are people who are Muslim, there are people who are Christians, and there are people who are animist. And that's different from Darfur, because in Darfur, everybody was basically Muslim. So you had these groups, their churches and their mosques were being attacked and burned down in the Nuba Mountains. And so, you know, slowly but surely, these people would flee up into the mountains and then start living up in the mountains. And that's when this whole situation became protracted, because the people in the mountains then did not have ready access to their fields, their produce, or their food stores, meaning the grain, you know, that they had in, they keep them in gigantic jars. I mean, when I say gigantic, I'm talking 4, 5, 6 feet high and 3, 4 feet wide, and they often take up a room unto themselves. And so they didn't have access to that, so they were in the mountains. You there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
So that was basically the situation. Now, what was your last question? I'm sorry. I don't know if I got off on a tangent there.
No, you're good. Let me pursue that then and follow on to that. So the second civil war has emerged. The Nuba are being targeted as part of the civil war. You describe this as genocide by attrition. Why do you think that's the best label?
Yeah, that's is an interesting situation. The first person to use that phrase was a fellow named Alex DeWall, who was living in the Nuba Mountains at the time. He was a doctoral candidate at Oxford University, and he had been conducting his doctoral work research in the Nuba Mountains, and he saw this situation unfolding. And basically what he asserted is this, is that the government of Sudan came in and they would either bomb the farms, burn the farms down, or take over the land and make it part and parcel of these gigantic mechanized farms. And then they would either steal the grain that was in the granary, or they would burn, you know, destroy that by burning it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were basically depriving the people of their food source. Now, the people then, as I said, fled up into the mountains. A lot of these people were fearful of coming back down to the village because they knew that the government of Sudan troops were there, and so they obviously feared being killed. So they didn't dare go back and try to harvest their crops, if they even existed any longer, or to go and try to retrieve the grain that had already been processed. But over and above that, once these people were in the Nuba Mountains, and when I say the Nuba Mountains, I'm talking the actual mountains, they were without food, as I mentioned. And so what they did is they initially existed on the little food that they brought up with them, and then they had to start carving out ways to either grow little patches of food, but the problem is there's not much soil at all in these mountains. And so then a lot of people started traveling by foot for days and days and days at a time to get food, bring it back to their family members. But by the time they got back, within a day or two, they would have to leave again for 2 and 3 days, you know, to come back with more food. And the situation kept getting more and more desperate, and ultimately these people resorted to eating anything and everything they could. They started digging up roots and boiling those, and then mashing them and drying them out, and mashing them again, and then putting them in with any bit of sorghum they might have, which is a traditional food there. They started pulling leaves off of trees. They would eat any and all fruit, whether it was poisonous or not. The amazing thing was they did end up eating a lot of poisonous roots and fruits and leaves, and they knew that they were poisonous. But what they did is, and this is spelled out time and again in these interviews in this book, is knowing that these leaves and roots, plants were poisonous, they would boil them once, and then they would strain the water, boil the you know, the plants again, strain the water, boil it again. So they almost always did it three times, and then they would let it dry for a couple of days. Then they would beat it into not a powder, but these granules, and then they would use that to put in with any other food they had, and basically what it did was to fill their stomachs. That's almost the only reason they ate this stuff. Now, the sad thing is that a lot of people died as a result of, one, a lack of food, but also, particularly elderly and infants, their systems could not take this this food that was poisonous. And even though they had tried to bleach out the poison, it did have an ill impact on a lot of the elderly and babies, and they died a terrible death as a result of this. Now, the other part of the equation here is that the government of Sudan knew that this was happening, knew that these people were virtually starving in the mountains, and didn't do anything about it. But not only did not do anything about it, they literally prevented any humanitarian aid from coming in to provide food for these individuals who were suffering severe malnutrition and starvation. And so Alex DeWall used a term, a concept that was actually originally coined by a woman named Helen Fine, who's a very noted scholar of genocide studies, and he used her concept to describe what was happening in the Nuba Mountains at that time. So it was genocide by attrition, basically denying them food, denying them humanitarian aid, and while fully cognizant of the fact that the people were starving, and purposely denying them this aid.
You mentioned the interviews you've done, and this is a big part of the book. How did you end up finding interview subjects?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting situation because I mentioned meeting this fellow in Nairobi on the plane. And by the time I met him, which was about 2009, by this time I had returned to Chad three times. And so I had been interviewing, as I mentioned, people in the refugee camps along the Chad-Darfur border. I was also interviewing people from Darfur who were residing in Jemena, the capital of Chad. And as I mentioned, I really wanted to get into Darfur to interview the people in Darfur. Well, when I spoke to this fellow that evening as we were flying from Nairobi to Amsterdam, I said, you know, I've really been trying to get into, not the Nuba Mountains, but into Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I can't help you with Darfur, but I can get you into Sudan. And, you know, I can get you up to the Nuba Mountains. And he said, what you'll be particularly interested in is this. He said, there is an IDP camp, an internally displaced persons
mm-hmm.
camp.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of a main town in the Nuba Mountains called Kauta. And these people were from Darfur. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, that would be incredible to be able to interview them. And so initially I flew to Kauta to seek interviews with these IDPs from Darfur. And so, in fact, I did go out there and I interviewed a lot of the people from Darfur in this small IDP camp. But while I was doing this, I was residing in the evenings in a compound of an NGO in Kauta, and you know, as you meet people, you start asking about, well, you know, or they'll start telling you about the history of the place. And I kept hearing over and over again these stories about what had transpired in the Nuba Mountains back in the 1990s. Now, I had some information and an inkling of what happened, but not much depth. But the more stories I heard, the more intrigued I became, and I knew that there had been little written on this. I was familiar with something that had come out by Alex DeWall and a group that he worked with in England called African Rights. But I thought, you know, this is the perfect opportunity. While I'm here, I can interview people in regard to what transpired in the Nuba Mountains in the 1990s. So what I did then is I began to split my time between the IDP camp. Hmm. I would go out there every morning, but then in the afternoon and early evenings, I would interview people back in Kauta about what transpired in the Nuba Mountains. And I just got the word out that I was interested in meeting people who had lived in the Nuba Mountains between you know, late 1980s and the late 1990s, who had experienced either the shelling or the attacks, or people who had been in peace camps, or people who had suffered, you know, the because of extreme hunger. Word got out and people started approaching me, and also people started saying, well, you know, you really need to speak to so-and-so. Hmm. And so I would simply go out and I would ask people if they would be interviewed or not. And I told them, of course, that as I always do, they're not compelled to do it. If they say no, that's fine. I told them what I was doing. I told them I was interested in what had transpired at the time. And at that time, I said I was interested in writing this up as a research article, because there had been so little written about it, as far as I could ascertain. And so I had really at the time no thought about working on a book, because I was already working on another massive book on on Darfur. And but the longer and the more people I interviewed, the more immersed I became into the situation in the Nuba Mountains. And then I began meeting individuals who had fought as soldiers with the FPLM, and their stories then were radically different from the civilians. And I thought, you know, since there's not that much out there about this, it would behoove me to come back here and continue this research. So I returned two more times to the Nuba Mountains on this NGO plane, and then I've been back a number of times crossing over the border. So, I just decided, I think I've got access. Very few people have access to this region. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Let's move forward with this project.
And they're really startling interviews. And you've already mentioned one of the kind of themes that comes through repeatedly, and the sheer amount of space devoted to hunger and the detail with which they recount the kind of ways in which they tried to adapt to this hunger and to use resources that we wouldn't ordinarily consider food. What are some of the other themes that come through? Is there a kind of a uniform set of experiences, or?
Certainly one is hunger. Another one that I thought was particularly interesting was the impact on the children. You know, oftentimes you'll read about various genocides, the way the children suffered. And certainly some of these interviews speak to that, but they also speak to how some of these young people were involved in, for example, carrying food, carrying not weapons, but ammunition, miles and miles and miles from South Sudan up into the Nuba Mountains. They talk about being on their own as their parents went to seek food. They talked about living in this area where they were constantly being attacked by the government of Sudan, and what that meant on a daily basis to them. I mean, some of them talk about, there was one young woman who talked about walking from this village of Kauda to another village called Hebon. And if you drive between Kauda and Hebon, it takes maybe a half an hour over, bumpy dirt roads. But it's a good walk from where they were walking from. But they talk about walking along the way, and all of a sudden there's an attack, and they all scatter, and they're all very frightened because they're young and they don't know what happened to their friends, and then they try to get back home. So a lot of the interviews are of individuals who were young at the time. I mean, another man, and this becomes kind of a theme as well, is how the families ultimately, meaning the Nuba Mountains, people of the Nuba Mountains, their families were destroyed in various ways. And for example, I mean, a lot of the fathers would leave and never come back, and families would assume that the fathers had probably been killed in battle, and yet they had not been notified, which was not unusual. Another young man I'll never forget told me that his mother was not right in the head. I mean, basically, she was suffering still from, the shock of that period of time, and probably, had a very difficult time getting through the day to day. And he said that he basically feels that he's her son, he's her husband, in the sense that he has to take care of everything and to make sure that she's okay, make sure that the siblings are okay. And in that regard, another theme is lost childhoods, because what they saw and what they experienced and what they ended up doing in these fragmented families had a dramatic impact on them and continues through this day.
I'm curious, briefly, because I want to move on in a moment, but I'm struck by the fact that you said you did these interviews all day. What kind of emotional experience was that for you?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because from 2004, the first interviews that I conducted in the Nuba Mountains was 2010, but between 2004... and 2010, I'd been conducting interviews in Chad, again in the refugee camps, in Jemena. Also, I had conducted scores of interviews in Rwanda in 2008, 9, and 10, beginning with my Fulbright in Rwanda. And The reason I mention these is that the interviews with the people from Darfur and the people from Rwanda were overwhelming in the sense that they were, the stories that people were relating about their experiences were overwhelmingly violent and, I mean, horrifying. And this is particularly true of the people in Rwanda. And I have to say, during those interviews, I had a very difficult time. I would catch myself in the camp. This is in Gozbeta, in a refugee camp, in a UNHCR refugee camp. I would catch myself while I was interviewing, literally biting down on my lip. As I heard something that was absolutely horrific and made me so sad, and I didn't want to emote in front of the people because it was so difficult conducting the interviews and so difficult for the people, I mean, relating their stories, that I didn't want to add another layer of complication. And so I would bite down on my lip. I'm sure they wondered, why has this guy gone silent? And I would compose myself that way and then continue. I did exactly the same thing in Rwanda, and probably even more times in Rwanda, because I was conducting interviews almost every single day for 6 months. And I mean, the stories there, just one after another, where entire families were wiped out in the most gruesome ways. And the people, conveyed their experiences in very graphic images. So by the time I got to the Nuba Mountains, I don't want to say that I was inured to crimes against humanity, stories about crimes against humanity and genocide, but first of all, they were somewhat different in the sense that a lot of the people, while they saw violence, didn't see a lot of their, with certain exceptions, of course, didn't see a lot of their family members killed, tortured, cut up in the most savage ways, but they did suffer incredibly from this hunger. And while it had an impact on me, and there were points in time where, again, I would find myself going silent during an interview, it didn't happen as often. But at the same time, I was doing this all day long, and obviously the people had suffered terribly. But I think part of the way I handled it was in the Nuba Mountains. I had Ramadan, my interpreter, who became a friend, and we would take time out, to talk about this, that, and the other, which was kind of a decompression time. And I also made some, good friends in the area, locals, and when I would go over to what they refer to as their Tukul's homes, we wouldn't talk about the starvation. We would talk about, things that were happening in the community or in their families. And, a lot of times it was just, one-on-one chats, like you would have with any neighbors. So I think that helped me decompress. But I don't recall myself having as great a difficulty after either during the interviews or after the interviews in the Nuba Mountains, as I did in Rwanda and in Chad with the Darfur folks.
Well, let's go back to the historical narrative, and this stage of the conflict ends with something called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement.
Right.
Why were the warring parties willing to cut a deal, and what arrangements did this agreement make for the people of the Nuba Mountains?
Yeah, well, that Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which was made in 2005, which was agreed on in 2005, was a long time coming, and the international community, including the United States, the United Nations, and other nations, were involved with the government of Sudan and, of course, the SPLM over a good number of years trying to work out a compromise to the end of this conflict. ultimately, I mentioned, you know, roughly 2,000 million people were killed, and I think both sides were ready to come to some sort of an agreement. Now, this is conjecture, but during this very same period, of course, Darfur had exploded in 2003. And Darfur is in the southwest of Sudan, adjacent to the state of South Kordofan. And so all of a sudden, the government of Sudan had its hands full with the insurrection in Darfur. So I think that that may have, you know, made them maybe more interested in trying to end this civil war, because they would have had the entire South up in arms if they didn't do something with the South that was engaged in the civil war. But at the same time, this war was bleeding the government of Sudan of its economic wealth. They're pouring a lot of manpower and a lot of money into fighting the South. At the same time, by 2005, it was becoming rather evident that the International Criminal Court was going after President Omar al-Bashir on charges of genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes, and not just al-Bashir, but others such as Ahmed Haroon. So that was a factor as well. And the international community was very keen on ending this war, and they were putting a lot of pressure on Omar al-Bashir and the government of Sudan to come around to end it. And there were also, at the same time, there were these different deals being made. For example, the United States purportedly was, there was this quid pro quo, if you will, where the government of Sudan allowed the United States to track terrorists through Sudan to try to capture them. And so the United States was relying on Sudan to a certain extent, and there were other members of the UN Security Council that were very close to Sudan. For example, China had a gigantic, and still does, petroleum interest in Sudan. That is, they purchased a lot of the petroleum from Sudan, and they also had a gigantic weapons deal, and Russia had a gigantic weapons deal as well. So there were a lot of parties that were interested in Sudan. Obviously, some had ulterior motives, but they all had an interest in one way or another. And the people of the South, I mean, they were more than ready for peace, because, you know, they experienced all they knew. There was a generation, all they knew was war. So it's from the pressure of the international community, and I think this bleeding of the economy and manpower, there was enough interest to bring both sides together, and there were enough areas where they could compromise. For example, Abyei, which is in the south, is a main oil-producing region. And so there was the interest, of course, by Sudan to make sure that they still had access to the petroleum, and yet the South wanted access to that as well. And so that was a place of compromise. So there was a lot of compromise going back and forth. Ultimately, the CPA, what it came down to is that the government of Sudan agreed that the South would hold a referendum And the people of the South would vote in this referendum, and basically they would decide one of two things. They would either decide to remain a part of Sudan, what this fellow I mentioned before, Grang, referred to as a new Sudan. And what he meant by that is a Sudan where the people in the peripheries, and what I mean by that is the individuals who pretty much control Sudan live in what is referred to as the Riverine Valley, which is where Khartoum is located, and it's the confluence of the Blue and White Nile. And everybody outside of the Riverine Valley, and that is the vast majority of the people in Sudan, are referred to as the peripheries. And the peripheries have always been second-class citizens. They've always felt disenfranchised, that they're perceived as unsophisticated, not as smart, with fewer rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was that desire by the South to, you know, to establish this, well, at least by Grang and his people, this new Sudan. It was a vision of a Sudan where everybody, no matter what their religion was, what their politics were, what their educational background was, would have equal rights. And then the other side of the coin was people could vote to remove themselves from Sudan and establish their own nation. Ultimately, the people voted in favor of establishing a separate nation, and that nation, of course, was constituted as the Republic of South Sudan, and it's the newest nation in the Nation of Communities, and the capital is Juba, the largest town in South Sudan, and it controls South Sudan controls part of Abyei, and there's still that conflict in Abyei over the petroleum, which is very interesting because all the petroleum has to go north up to the port in Sudan to be put on ships. And so any oil that South Sudan controls has to go through Sudan. So there's still that area where they've got to compromise. But anyways, the ultimate decision was to go with a new nation. That new nation was established. But what happened is there was an agreement that certain areas later would decide what their situation was going to be. And one of those areas was the Nuba Mountains. And the Nuba Mountains people, though, were furious that they were not allowed to vote in a referendum because they wanted to remain with the South. The same is true of the people in the Blue Nile state. And so from the get-go, people in the Nuba Mountains were saying, look, we don't want any part of the government of Sudan. We fought with the South against Khartoum. They're obviously going to want some sort of retribution against us, or they're going to treat us in ill ways because we fought along the side of the South, and we fear that they may, you know, come down here and repeat what they did in the 1990s. So and the Blue Nile pretty much felt the same way, but that's the way it went. I mean, once that referendum went through, South Kordofan, the Nuba Mountains, the Blue Nile remained part of the North. And so that was really the a new point of crisis, which exploded in the latest war, or which resulted in the latest war.
And the latest war starts 3 years ago, am I right?
June 2011. Right.
Okay.
June 2011, there had been a lot of talk. In fact, I was in the Nuba Mountains in December 2012, December 2010 and January 2011. And it was very interesting because almost every single night, rumors floated around about what was happening in regard to what was happening in Kadugli. Kadugli is the capital of South Kordofan, which was controlled by the government of Sudan. And so rumors were floating around in regard to what was being said by the government officials there in regard to the Nuba Mountains, what was going to happen. In the Nuba Mountains in Kauta, one night, a form or like a circular went up. It was actually posted to a tree in the souk, and it was in Arabic. And it basically was stating that the government of Sudan was planning to attack the Nuba Mountains people if the Nuba Mountains people did not cooperate with the government of Sudan and did not back off of saying that it was going to rebel if the government of Sudan did not meet certain needs. Two nights in a row, there were gigantic rallies in January 2011 where people were, I mean, thousands of people were there at night, and people were yelling that, people on the stage were yelling, look, we know that there are spies in the crowd here from the north, from Khartoum. We want you to tell al-Bashir that al-Bashir to give himself up to the ICC. We want Haroon to give himself up to the ICC. We don't want any part of the north. We're ready to put our uniforms back on, pick up our weapons, and go to war. And if this time we do, we'll go all the way to Khartoum. So there were rumors of war for a good 7 months before the war actually broke out. And at the same time, al-Bashir was threatening the people of the Nuba Mountains. In fact, at one point, he flew to Kadugli and made the statement that if the Nuba Mountains people basically didn't watch themselves, they were going to suffer exactly the same way they did in the 1990s. And he didn't say any more than that, but the people knew very clearly what he was talking about, that, you know, they were going to not only be attacked physically, but they were, you know, going to be denied food. They might start starving again, and they weren't sure about the peace camp. The peace camps have never come about, but the attacks and the starvation is going on now.
So yeah, so that was my next question. Actually, you characterize in your article in Genocide Studies International, actually in a footnote, you suggest that you think of this war as a civil war in which the government of Sudan has committed, and I'm going to kind of add an adjective here, significant or extensive human rights violations. Why do you choose that way of characterizing it?
Well, it is a civil war. First of all, I've talked to one individual after another in the Nuba Mountains, and I'm talking about citizens that are not that have no official position with either, you know, the government of Sudan or the SPLM or anybody else. I've also talked with soldiers who are with the SPLM. I've also talked with leaders who are in the SPLM. Mm-hmm. And almost to a person, I've heard over and over again that that phrase, that refrain that I just mentioned, we're going to take this war all the way to Khartoum. And when I questioned people about that, I said, well, basically what you're saying then is that you're going to overthrow al-Bashir. That's your intent. And they said, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. And one fellow told me, a rebel soldier, we're going to put in a new government, and the new government is going to establish a government that is for all the people so that all the people have their basic rights. And I played the devil's advocate at that point, because I said, well, I said, you know, that's a great vision and hope, but look at what's transpiring in South Sudan already. And this is before December 2013 before war broke out in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. And what I was referring to is that there were a number of groups that were fighting among themselves, particularly the Dinka and Nuer in South Sudan. And there was a lot of conflict in different parts of the country, and there were threats that the or accusations that the main government was guilty of malfeasance and all sorts of corruption. And I said, you know, there are a lot of people in that country that are very disenchanted with the way things are going. They feel disenfranchised under this new government. And he said, well, it's going to be different here. You know, you can't really argue with people like that, but it was interesting listening to what they had to say. And so it was definitely a civil war. I mean, it was basically initially the Nuba Mountains against the government of Sudan. But as I returned to the Nuba Mountains, I started hearing different stories. And what I mean by that is that slowly but surely, it wasn't just the people of the Nuba Mountains who were now fighting the government of Sudan, but I was told that there were individuals coming over from Darfur to fight with the people of the Nuba Mountains against the government of Sudan. I heard that there were actually, they didn't use the term, mercenaries who were coming from different countries, Chad, Eritrea, to fight on the behalf of the people of the Nuba Mountains. All with the vision of overthrowing the government and establishing a new government. Now, what I heard most recently, because I just got back from South Sudan about a month ago, what I've heard now is that there are members of the Janjaweed, the former Janjaweed, who, you know, were the militia fighting alongside the government of Sudan against the people of Darfur. They've now come over, and they're fighting with the government of Sudan against, I'll say, the people of Nuba and their, you know, their cohorts. Also, JEM, which is the Justice and Equality Movement, which was one of the initial rebel groups in Darfur to fight against the government of Sudan, they've now come over, and they're fighting on the side of the people of Nuba Mountains, but they're creating all sorts of havoc both in South Kordofan and in the new Republic of South Sudan. Basically, what they're doing is they're acting like, out-and-out criminals, really. They're creating havoc in both places. And I actually heard that Adel Aziz, who is the leader of the SPLM North, actually told JEM that they had to back off from where they were located in South Kordofan, north south Kordofan, and go to another region, and if they created any more havoc, that they were going to be kicked out of South Kordofan altogether. And then in the Republic of South Sudan, I mean, they've been killing people left and right, and it seems as if neither the government nor the rebel groups from South Sudan can control them. I mean, they're just out of control.
One of the things you've been doing, then, is to be active in trying to persuade the American government to somehow, and I'm going to use this word broadly rather than specifically, right, to intervene, to be more active in the affairs of the Sudan and in this conflict. How have you tried to do this, and what kind of steps have you recommended the government take?
Right. Let me take the second part of the question first. What I've not asked them to do, meaning the U.S. government, is because I don't think they would. I've not asked them to go to intervene militarily. Now, there are individuals who are calling for no-fly zones over South Cordovan, the Nuba Mountains. There are others who would like to see the government go in basically, you know, take control of the situation. What I've basically argued for the past 3 years is the establishment of a humanitarian corridor. And it's very simple. The whole idea is to establish this corridor from the border of South Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan and South Kordofan. And it's to allow transport of food and medical aid up into the Nuba Mountains so that these people who were without food, without any sort of medical attention, because there's only one real hospital in the whole region of the Nuba Mountains, and it's pretty far north. These people are pretty much without any basic needs when they're being bombed. And I thought, well, all right, if they could establish that and let the government of Sudan know that, look, we're going to bring this food up. Government of Sudan officials can witness the delivery of this food so that it's not getting into the hands of the rebels. It's getting to the people, you know, which I realize might be naive because once the people have it, certainly the rebels can get a hold of it. But, you know, that was it. That was it. Mm-hmm. And I've argued this along with a good number of genocide scholars who have signed on to letters that I've crafted either myself or I've crafted with one or two or three other genocide scholars. And we have sent these letters to everyone from President Obama to Hillary Clinton when she was U.S. Secretary of State, to Susan Rice when she was the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., to Samantha Power when she was heading up the Atrocities Prevention Board, to the special U.S. Envoy to Sudan. And basically what we argued is, you know, this situation, meaning the Nuba Mountains, has been going on since June 2011. Al-Bashir has already threatened to do what Sudan had done to the people in the 1990s, and so we talk about the genocide by attrition and the starvation. We note that people already have been flooding, and this has been going on for the past 3 years, flooding over the border into South Sudan, and that different organizations from Samaritan's Purse, from Oxfam, from Doctors Without Borders have all attested to the fact that a lot of these people who are coming across the border are suffering from malnutrition to severe malnutrition to almost, you know, well, there's ample evidence that people have died of starvation on the way down, down through the Nuba Mountains on their way to South Sudan, and that these people need help, and they need help as soon as possible because it's causing all sorts of conflict, you know, along the border of South Sudan. It's causing conflict with the people in the Republic of South Sudan who resent these people being on their land. There are a lot of people still up in the mountains who are so far removed from towns that they don't have access to food. We also talked about the fact that people are coming into the one hospital, it's Mother of Mercy Hospital in a place called Goodell, who the doctor there has attested to the fact that people have come in and there's evidence that they're suffering from malnutrition and severe malnutrition as well. So we've made various arguments in various ways over the years. We've sent numerous letters to the same people, to the Atrocities Prevention Board, which ostensibly was to address situations just like this one in the Nuba Mountains. I mean, President Obama established that back in, it was April 2012, I believe. He announced it, the establishment of the Atrocities Prevention Board at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in April, and basically stated that the focus of this Atrocities Prevention Board was going to be crimes against humanity and genocide. The whole idea was prevention, to try to prevent these acts. And what we stated is, look, you know, while this is not a case of genocide, though some people, I should say, this is an aside, there are certain scholars and activists who have already called it genocide. I don't. I say that it's a case of crimes against humanity and war crimes. But we stated in these letters that, you know, we have crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the time to prevent genocide is before genocide is going to be perpetrated. So you have all of these crimes against humanity being perpetrated. Now is the time to get in there and either, you know, diplomatically or through sanctions, and we've discussed this as well in these letters, you know, put pressure on the Sudanese government to halt the daily bombings and to halt the attacks on the villages and the farms and the schools and the churches and the mosques, and allow the people to come back to their villages. The only person who has really been open to discussing this was the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, and he actually got on the phone with us and talked to us and responded to our letters. None of the other parties that received letters from us, and a lot of these letters were sent registered mail so that we knew that these people had to, somebody had to sign for them on the other end. None of them even acknowledged the letter, let alone respond to the to our concerns. So, so Prince Lyman, though, who was the U.S. envoy, he ended up stepping down. And I'm not exactly sure why, but I can say that when we spoke with him on the phone, he was making both off-the-record comments, but his voice and the tone and tenor of what he was saying seemed to be one of frustration with the slowness of what was going on and, you know, the lack of progress, et cetera, et cetera. So, but nobody else has responded.
Well, there is a whole other interview in there about this question of how to intervene in to prevent genocide and when and what are the appropriate tactics to use. Unfortunately, our time is drawing short now. Maybe sometime later you'll agree to come back on the show and talk about that.
Sure.
But I would just like to conclude today with a couple brief questions. And the first is simple. For people interested in learning more about the region, what would you recommend to them?
Well, a couple of things. One, there's a very interesting group. It's a local group working in the Nuba Mountains. It was established by an American. It's called Eyes and Ears of the Nuba. They can go online, Google Eyes and Ears of the Nuba, and basically, this group is serving as a group of civilian journalists, or as they refer to themselves, citizen journalists. And every time there's an attack, these fellows go out on motorbikes or any way they can to these regions, and while these attacks are underway, they videotape the attacks, and then they write up a report on the attacks. And these are all posted on a regular basis on this website. So that's one way to stay abreast of what's going on. They're doing a great job. So that's one. Two, There are various organizations that are working on this. There are organizations actually in the United States that are comprised of Nuba Mountains citizens, who many of them are young people who have come to the United States to study. And so if they Google Nuba Mountains plus United States, they'll find that there are Nuba Mountain organizations in, for example, Virginia. There's another one in Lincoln, Nebraska. There's another one down in Louisiana, and one in Denver, Colorado. And what they do is they do have websites, and they try to the best of their ability to upload key documents and keep people apprised of what's happening over there. I have a new book coming out on the Nuba Mountains, and it addresses both the crisis in the 1990s as well as the crisis today. And this one is a book of original essays by scholars who have studied this issue, including scholars in Sudan some activists as well, who have spent many, many years. I mean, some of them have spent 20 years in the Sudan and really know the history and the politics inside and out. That's being published by Routledge. And it's coming out, I believe, in December. It's Crises in Sudan. I mean, those are probably the best ways. There's one other fellow who's doing really impressive work as well. I don't know the name of his website, but all they have to do is look up his first name. His name is Tomo, T-O-M-O, and then put plus Nuba Mountains. He's a journalist from Europe, and I've met Tomo a number of times. He's an amazing character, and he's probably spent as much time, if not more time, than most outsiders in the Nuba Mountains, and I'm talking about over the past 10 to 15 years, and he travels everywhere in the hardest ways. I mean, from foot to going up the Nile in these motorboats, and he's constantly covering what's happening and posting it, including videos. In fact, he posted an incredible video several months ago of a village being attacked by MiG jets, and the village basically was totally destroyed and ended up a smoldering ruins, just like you see if you go on Google Earth and look at Darfur, where they're just big round black circles.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for the interview. It's been wonderfully interesting and enlightening. I know you're headed back to the region sometime in the future, and I want to wish you safe travels, and hopefully sometime down the road you'll be willing to come on the program again.
That'd be great. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an interview with Samuel Totten about his book Genocide by Attrition, The Nuba Mountains of Sudan. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you come back next time for a special episode of the podcast. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide. To recognize this, the next show will feature a panel discussion around the question, what do we now know about the Rwanda genocide 20 years after? Scott Strauss, Lars Waldorf, and Leanne Fuji will all join me to help discuss this question. I hope you join us for that special podcast. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.